Do you remember Super Rugby? Of course you do, because it was the best damn rugby tournament in the world. Though it may no longer exist, its legend always lives on. And to relive the peak of this tournament, former Bulls and Springbok center and multiple Super Rugby title winner, Bennett Olivier joins Ben in studio. The purists will say that the Super 12 was the pinnacle, but deep down, we all know the days of the Super 14, when Feyenoord's blonde locks were crashing through defenses, was the absolute best. It was a time of trophies, treffers, and Tannies gone wild on the Oost Pavilion. It's the peak of Super Rugby Show with Bennett Olivier. Let's get into it. All right, welcome to it. This is the episode in rugby terms I've been wanting to do for quite some time, because as a 43-year-old man, Super Rugby was like the greatest thing growing up. Yes, I was born in Cape Town, so I was a Stormers fan, unlike this jersey you might show here. But after having Akono Ndogani on the show a few weeks back and how horrified he was about me being in a VIP today, kind of making right here. But yeah, Super Rugby was so special because it was the first time where we had like blockbuster games each and every weekend. And I know a lot of people always say that Super Rugby's prime was Super 12, but I'll go a step further and say the Super 14 was actually the best. And our guest today is living proof of that, because we actually had people who won the tournament. Bennett Olivier, three-time Super Rugby champion. That still means a lot to you, right?
Most definitely. Like you just said, I think Super Rugby was probably one of the best competitions there were. Like you said, Super 12 was pretty nice. But I must say my favorite was the Super 14 as well, where you played home and away against both sides, where they changed the Super 15 a little bit later on. But being the first South African side that actually won the competition was quite special, and doing it three times was a special time. And I must say that sometimes you relive the moments, but you try not to, though. But it's there and it's fresh, and everyone quite enjoyed it, because I think back in the day, a lot of people knew all the players. If you think about the Bulls, the Crusaders, the Reds, whoever it might be, they knew all the guys. Where the competitions these days, you might know the Bulls or the Stormers, but other than that, you don't know the other sides. And people actually, they lived in the time. When we won the Super Rugby, for instance, at Loftus 29 and 2010, from Sunday, well, basically from Saturday evening after the semifinals, people were starting to queue for the whole week. And those are the moments that actually made it a little bit more special. And the thing is also, for the kids and everyone out there, I must say everyone lived for Super Rugby. Even the 2007 one against the Sharks, that is also it's a different competition, but it's also a special one to have won at that stage.
Well, it was. I mean, you've just basically gone through our entire show notes at an absolute blistering pace. But it was a really, really cool time. And I think that's one of the reasons why, I mean, Sandile's not with us today, because I think he's still stuck in Ibiza somewhere. But we loved looking back on special times in sport, because you need to give it a bit of breathing room. Like, when you were there, you were the absolute prime of your career. Nothing could really go wrong. I mean, like, looking back on your career now, to say you've won Super Rugby three times is actually really incredible. People almost forget, because we're so focused on what's in front of us right now. URC, World Cup, Springboks, Champions Cup, whatever it is. But it really was just the most amazing time of excitement around rugby. Saturdays meant so much. So that's what we're going to unpack today. I love the fact that you are here and you were able to kind of just be our guest for such a cool topic. But just to kind of look at a couple of stats just to kick things off here. Now, Vanet doesn't need any more smoke blown towards him here. I mean, we know he had a good career, but you played 110 Super Rugby games for the Bulls. 110. Like, that's crazy. 29 tries within that. You were an integral part of this team throughout. Along with that, 38 bock caps, Rugby World Cup winners medal 2007 with the Springboks, and you were there when we beat the Lions in 2009. Like, as sports careers, like rugby careers go, I mean, there's nothing else you really could have achieved within that time. But the whole thing about Super Rugby is, when you were growing up, you would have had the first little glimpse, maybe Super 10 was like this infancy, the strange little tournament that came around. Like, teams like Transvaal, Northern Transvaal, Western Province took on teams like Waikato and Auckland. Queensland were there. So it was still very, very small. Then when it became the Super 12, you were still very much in high school, right? So what, grade 10?
Yeah, probably grade 10, grade 9.
Okay, so another reason why I really wanted you to be the guy on the Bulls here, because you were actually like the Bulls blueprint. Went to school at Uffies. Then you went to University of Pretoria and obviously decorated in both times from there. What was your first inclusion or activity within the Bulls structure itself?
So just when I finished school in 2001, I got invited to train with the Bulls, the Super Rugby side at that stage. And Heineke Meyer was a coach. He was from the Westhuizen, was still involved. And my first training session, myself and Derek Ogaard was there. It wasn't trials, but it was something sort of. And
all of 18 years old, huh?
Just out of school. It was that December, January holidays. So there was no matric holidays for me. It was
straight into training. Getting hammered, first taste of freedom, and here you are. Yeah,
but I had the other excitement of training with the guys like US on the Vestas and the Bulls side at that stage wasn't as good. Well, there were lots of names, but they struggled. They actually, in 2002, though, I think they lost 11 out of 12 games. But anyway, so that December, January, I started joining training with the Bulls. Freddie Prey was there as well. And obviously not knowing what I'm in for, and US was basically running the show, being an 18-year-old. So obviously I got stuck into it straight away, doing my level best to impress Heineke, US, all those guys. And I was probably into training for about 10 minutes. And then US called me over. He said to me, so not as nice as I'm saying now, but what are you doing? I said, what do you mean what I'm doing? I'm training. He's like, firstly, never talk back. Second thing, get off the field. So I'm like, geez, I don't know. Yours is running the show. And I looked over at Heineke, and Heineke just said to me, well, he's your captain, so get off the field. Anyway, 2-3 months later, I started playing for Tickies. Dick Mill was a coach at the time, so I played Ticks 1. And they had the Vodacom side set up. There's like a training match against Ticks 1 at that stage. And I was center, playing against the likes of Joost, he didn't actually play, but he was there. Fricky Walsh, Three Skulls, JP Nell, Rudy Pierre, all those guys. And I had a blind of a game. I think I scored the first three tries in the game. Obviously the senior guys weren't too happy about that. And literally 20 minutes after the game, Anakin phoned me and said, listen, you want to come join us in the Vodacom? He wants me to play there. And I'm like, yes, okay. So it was quite a rapid start into my career, playing with all the guys I basically looked up to. But it was a special time, and it's almost like it happened yesterday. You can't forget it. And at that stage, I was playing a bit for the Bulls Vodacom side and for Tickies at that stage, because Dick was also a massive part of my growth into becoming a senior player and everything. He gave me a lot of advice, someone I looked up to. And as like you said, playing for those guys, with those guys, being 18-year-old, suddenly I got Dick Meer coaching me, who was also a Springbok center. And I was a youngster from Welkom, actually. So although I was at Uffies, I was only there for 2 years. And suddenly in the big leagues with all these big names, 2 years ago I watched Super Rugby. Now I'm starting to play in it. So it was special times. And I must say it happened quite quickly at that stage.
So you said it happened quite quickly. I mean, if you think back what you said there, 2002 it was, that the Bulls were terrible. They were losing games left, right, and center. I remember watching, I think, when Victor Matfield first came online as a player, he was like a shining light within the team that just couldn't get anything right. But then, so Heineke is now finding his feet more as a Super Rugby coach. So 2003, finished sixth. 2004, finished sixth again. 2005, finished third. So this time around, beaten by the Waratahs in the semis. 2006, you guys finished fourth, beaten by the Crusaders in the semis. When you got into this original thing, right, again, from a legacy of losing to the big teams, especially away, what was it about at that time? Did you guys feel like you just weren't good enough, or was it the fact that those guys were more advanced, more professional where you were?
I think the thing was in 2002, when the Bulls lost 11 out of 12 games, they came back. And after the last match, Heineke sat in the change room. I wasn't there at the time, but Heineke said to the boys, listen, go on holiday, 2-3 weeks, we get back, and then we hit the ground running for the Grey Cup. And literally Monday morning, Heineke got a phone call saying, listen, all the boys at the pitch, they want to train. And he got there and he said to everyone, what are you guys doing? I said, no, we want to start now. There's no holidays. And I think at that stage, Heineke had a dream and a plan, which he said to everyone. And he basically gave you a choice. Either you buy in or you can go. And I think all the players bought into that dream, what he wanted to start building. He wanted to be the first guy to win the Super Rugby, which eventually we did. So I think the culture he created at the Bulls was quite special. And like I said, everyone bought into it. Although I think for many years people thought the Bulls had a massive drinking culture, but at that stage it was pretty decent. But
wasn't that most teams though?
I think it's a sporting thing. It's you stay under pressure during the week, so to take a bit of time off and just have a few beers. Because I remember Mvaini always, when the guys had the forwards had a scrum session, he'd afterwards pull up the cooler bag, sit on the side on the side of the scrum machine, and the boys having beers. And the backline players were running up and down and thinking, just what about us? So then we'd go afterwards. So I think it's, getting back to the point, I think it's the culture Anika created within the players, and I think everyone bought into it. And then I think also what he did is there was a good balance between experience and youth coming through. Like I said, being an 18-year-old Derek Hougaard and myself playing with all those guys, suddenly they're your teammates, they're your mates. They're not the guys you're looking up to anymore. And I think within that, the players also established a culture which was pretty good in terms of, okay, boys, listen, you know what, when we work hard, and everyone's got a job to do, so don't let anyone else do your job, just do your job, and then afterwards we can have a bit of fun. So I think that was probably one of the best things that they did. And going into, I remember 2005, I think it was the first semi-final we played in, and then in 2006 against the Crusaders, we actually saw that it's possible. I think the belief before that wasn't quite there, because if you think late 90s, yes, the guys were getting hammering 60, 70 points in a, yep, in a game, and suddenly we were losing with 5, 10, 15 points maybe. So it dropped down quite a bit. So I think the belief in the players also started creeping in. And like I said, I think it's buying into the system, what we're going to do. A lot of people said, oh, we play crash ball rugby. It was never that. The idea was always run to score. So, and if you don't score, this is the next phase. And I think we only utilized the players that we had at that stage. And I think if you think Etienne Buerta, who was he was never a crash ball rugby player. He had actually brilliant feet. So they'd started adapting the game plan according to what the players' abilities are, and what our strengths were. And like I said, we bought into that. So we did what worked for us.
But I feel like this time we're leading up to now, the 2007, which is the first time you guys won the Super Rugby title. It's like, it was also indicative of like the Springbok form. Maybe the belief wasn't quite there. Sure, we had won a World Cup in 95. We'd been pretty good. We'd won some Tri-Nations things here and there. But there was almost inevitability, like the All Blacks were going to beat us, especially away from home. We could have some plucky performances here. Ricky January scored that try. There would be moments like that. But we never really felt we had the belief to really go on. So now, as you say, you got something that's building under Heineke. You go into 2007. Now, the only other team that's done anything really great in Super Rugby that time was the Sharks, were thereabouts. Also, they made it to a final prior to that, the first team to do so. And now, you guys, in 2007, number one and number two on the log. So that's like whole new territory here. Now, you guys, in order to get to get a home semi-final, you had to absolutely obliterate the Queensland Reds. Now, I feel it's a good way to pick up where 2007 was. You guys have gone from a stage from being more competitive to now being a whole bunch better. But now you've got to have the belief that you can go and put like 90 points on a team. So talk us through like what that week was like, because it was basically, that was just before going into the semis, which then went on to the most memorable of finals.
I must say that was quite a memorable week. Obviously, playing the Reds, I think we needed to beat them by 72 points.
And the reason being is it had to go down a points difference. The Sharks were top of the log,
yeah,
but then it was you, the Blues, and Crusaders on the same points with a win in the final game.
That's it. So I think there were 72 points, and that whole week we trained quite well, and I think it was more mental thing than anything else. And always before captain's run, we had a meeting in the auditorium, and we sat there, and Heineke started the speech with basically self-belief. And he basically said, he walked in and he said to us, listen, guys, so we're going to win tomorrow. And there's no two ways about it. And it's not going to be a long speech. Okay, let's go for captain's run. And that was basically the team talk. And everyone's like, yes, okay, but normally it's a nice story and it's this and it's, and there was a moral to the story, and now it's just like, okay, we're going to win and let's go out. And we had the captain's run, and obviously then we actually had a pretty bad captain's run, to be honest. Balls were knocking around, and Heineken just said, listen guys, don't worry, we're not playing the game today, we're playing it tomorrow. And we pitched up the Saturday morning, and I think everyone just said, listen boys, we're going to do this. It's is what it is. And then the game started. They scored the first try. We were behind 7-0. They scored the first point, so it's a 3 penalty or whatever. And the next minute, it just started raining tries from left, right and centre. And also at that stage, my centre partner was Wayne Julius. So JP Nally used to be there. He wasn't there. Wayne Julius was there, and yeah, it's just one of those things. Everything just clicked on the day, and it worked for some reason. And I think it was the belief that Heineken could put into us and say, listen, we don't even need a big captain's run. It just is what it is. You just need to believe in yourself. So that was probably one of the most special games that we actually won, to get the home semi-final for that.
And that it really is. It's like Loftus going back now. It's Loftus at its complete prime as well, because those stadiums are packed out. I used to have friends that would drive from Joburg who weren't even rugby fans. They were like, we've got season tickets now at Loftus. It's that much of a vibe. Because that must have been the first time you played in front of such fanatical people who were just really baying for this now.
I get the question quite often. People ask you, what's your favorite stadium? For me, it's always Loftus, because it's home stadium. But also, if Loftus is full, it's the vibe is unbelievable.
It's the right size for it.
As soon as you get out the tunnel, you're onto the pitch, you feel your chest growing. And it's almost like you're Superman. Anything's possible. I think at that stage, 2007, it started building more, and also having the belief from supporters that we can do it. We played two semifinals to the 2 years prior to that, and everyone's like, okay, you guys are going to do this year, definitely. Third time lucky, it must happen. So I think it's just a belief all around. And like you said, Loftus, it's Fortress Loftus for us. It's like when you walk onto the pitch, doesn't matter, leave everything behind, your personal troubles or whatever, and what happens on the pitch is—it's all about that. And I think it's also like the belief in the players. We a lot of us became great mates. We brought together. We did basically everything together, which was quite nice. So it was a team environment of basically friends, which played a massive role in that all side.
I'll get back to that in a second, what like those games must have been like. Because I remember I went for a stadium day once, and I walked into the change rooms, and you see the different jerseys out, and then the guys give us like a rundown. It always felt like it was quite a special thing, because again, when a team is in a winning culture like that, Saturday is not another day. It's like the day. Everyone's lives are pointing towards this. So you hammer the Reds to the point that you managed to get into the second place, which gives you a home semi-final. Now it was the Crusaders, the all-invincible conquering Crusaders. That match, there wasn't a single try. The contrast must have been absolutely bizarre for you guys. You won that thing 27-12, not a single try. Was that, again, did I keep things tight, or was it just managing nerves and that was just what the outcome was?
I think obviously nerves plays a massive role into that, but I think having it was the first semi-final we had at home as well. So obviously the Loftus crowd at that stage was phenomenal. And we had a game plan that we said, listen, don't play too expensive, because we know the Crusaders at that stage, once the ball's on the ground, they pounce on it.
Counter-attack.
Yes, you get hammered on that. So it was basically keep the ball a little bit tighter. We had different phases of play that we called, and it was basically forwards, then backs. But the ball was never supposed to go past myself, basically. And that actually worked for us in that sense. But I think after we beat the Reds, the belief that we can actually win the Super Rugby is there. And to get back to the fact that I don't think the belief the belief in beating New Zealand sides was slim to none. And once we beat the Crusaders there, we actually saw, listen, these guys aren't invincible. And they had a massive side. Dan Carter, Richie McCaw, all those guys were playing. Casey Lalala, they had some phenomenal players. I think about 95-96% of the side were playing for the All Blacks at that stage.
This is what I love so much about this era. You were against the Crusaders team, which were also in a prime of their own. It wasn't like you were playing the top teams when they were on a bit of a low.
No, they were on the top of the game. I think they might have won, I'm not sure, 2 or 3 years prior that they won the Super Rugby, like straight on the bounce. So Heineken obviously instilled this belief into us. Listen, you just did an unbelievable thing last week, beating the Reds with 92-3, which is the biggest score up to today in Super Rugby history.
Yeah.
So why is this not possible? The Crusaders aren't invincible. And even with the likes of Richie McCaw and Dan Carter, and being a youngster at that stage, I was 20, 22 years, 21 years old, I just thought to myself, listen, doesn't matter. I'm a young boyki from Welkom. I know I'm as hard as nails. So today I'm going to knock these guys around. So at that stage, obviously, the cameras weren't all over. So I think there were a lot of, I know for a fact, there were a lot of fists flying around, buckies. I've actually got a good story about buckies. So
from that game in particular?
Actually, the semi-final in 2006, when we lost against the Crusaders in Christchurch. But I'll tell that you now. So at that stage, you can still, and we actually, the thing for us was, listen, today we're going to bully these guys. It is what it is. They you're not coming to Loftus. The pitch is hard. It's fast. But today we're going to manage the game and obviously knock these boys around, give them a proper welcome to South Africa. So, yeah, so it was quite a special one. But getting back to my story about Buckies, in 2006, when we played the Crusaders in Christchurch, it was quite a misty day. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face almost in the first half. But the game was going on, and there was one or two lineouts, and I got hit quite late. And Buckies just, he jogged past me, and he's like, number? I said, number two. And he said, okay. Game goes on. Eventually, we get a scrum on the 22-yard line on the 15. Scrum goes down. Next minute, if you go back on YouTube and you check, you can actually see the scrum just does that. It just moves, it pops a little bit. Next minute, hooker's on the ground. Buckies runs past me and says, got him. Then he knocked him one in the scrum. And I think that also, that plays a part that the boys actually started looking after one another. It wasn't the backs and the forwards, although there's always going banter around. But the guys are actually starting looking after one another and the differences and more in a personal capacity, which is quite nice.
It's amazing, hey, because you think it's a bit of a given in rugby, but people become so focused on what they do. And there's power within that, all within the rules, of course. But that's what builds a team, right? Rugby's a hard game. You need these kind of things to really galvanize guys.
Definitely. Obviously, camaraderie is a massive thing, especially in team sports. But within that, also, it builds character. In tough times, it builds character. You Absolutely. Can see where our person actually reacts in certain situations. And obviously, coming from 2002, the team changed quite a bit going forward. But that camaraderie and that character started to build. Where if you're in a tough situation, instead of panicking and saying, listen, guys, just we're behind 15, 20 points, let's just reset, go back to what we do. Because even from 2000s up to today, the basics basically stay the same. It does change, but the basics stay the same. And we just instilled that into our DNA at that stage, and the belief was the kicker at the end of it.
Which took you to Kings Park, because not only did the Sharks finish top of the log, they were pretty good in their semi. They beat the Blues 34-18, so they were destined for this. Now, the Sharks have had some heartbreaks before this. This was meant to be their trophy. You guys are doing well, but they probably felt that they were first in line to be the first SA team to raise the trophy.
So funny story on that. In 2005, when we played the semi-final. No, 2006. Sorry, 2006. We had to beat the Stormers down in Cape Town, I think with 32 or 35 points. There was a points difference in that as well. So they were basically already in the semi-finals. So it was impossible for us to beat the Stormers. They had Skalk Burger, John de Villiers, Mari Joubert, David Barry, all those guys were playing at that stage. All Springboks. It was 2005, yeah. And I think the points difference need to be 32 or something, like, I can't remember. But then eventually we actually beat the Stormers there. And the reason I remember it, because that night I became a Springbok in 2006. Yeah. I became a Springbok. And that again, it started instilling belief in what we can do and what is possible. So it was quite a nice period of time that. So yeah, I forgot your question.
Well, it was about like the Sharks might have felt that not only were the favorites, but they were kind of due because they got closer. Like they got to a final in the late 90s or mid 90s. They were always there, thereabouts.
Now, obviously they had a massive side at that stage.
Well, if you want, I can actually bring it up.
With John Smith and everyone.
There was, if you mind just, Flex, you mind just bring up the side there. So that is the Sharks team from 2007. And literally from 1 to 22, because back in those days it was also 22. There wasn't a 23rd oak on the bench. Dion Carson, John Smith, BJ Boerter, that was your front row. John was captain there. Johan Ackermann, who is now the new Bulls coach, was announced. Johan Muller, those are your locks. So they were solid. And then Jacques Boerter, AJ Fenter, Ryan Kankowski. That was a solid, solid back trio. And then their back line was star-studded. Ruan Pienaar, Butch James, halfbacks. Francois Steyn, JP Peterson on the wings. And then Brad Barrett's Waylon Murray centers. That was a good center pairing. And then Percy was the fullback. And then on the bench, you had Bismarck and the Beast on the bench. There's your two front rows. Alba van der Berg, Warren Brits. And then Bobby Skinstad was there. I forgot he was there. Roy Cockett, Adrian Jacobs, who are going to be an incumbent Springbok center.
Well, if you take that side, there's almost all of them, everyone played international rugby.
Solidly, yeah, exactly. And then you guys, on the other hand, weren't as star-studded, if you were to look at it in a critical perspective, but go through Steenkamp, Gary Boerter, Reinhard Gerber, that was your front row. Buckies and Victor, that's when they were starting to really become that dangerous duo. Pedri Vandenberg, Vickers van Heerden, and Pierre Spies. And then the back line again, this was a great back line. Frieda Priya, Derek Hochart, we had Tabana and Unagani on the wings, and then you and JP Nell. When Akwana was here a few weeks back, he had a story about JP Nell, because we were asking about what was it like playing against your brother. He's like, it was okay, like we were competitive. But like this one time I felt really, because he's the big brother, you know, he's the big twin. He saw JP hammer Odwa a few times. And he had to say, felt like he had to say to him, like, JP, just take it easy.
Yeah, but you must remember, Odwa was at the Bulls before Akwana.
Was he?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah, so, and that's the other thing. So we always, like myself and JP had a thing. We said, okay, we target one player. And at that stage, obviously, Odwa was at the Bulls. I think he was only there for one Super Rugby or something.
Okay.
And then he went to the Sharks. So we always targeted, and if it was someone we knew, we'd always target that one person. I think 2006 or 7, we thought one of the Sharks games, we actually went for Brad Barrett. So we picked someone before, and we'd literally knock him around in the loose scrum. We'd tackle late. We'd do, because at that stage you can still do it. The cameras weren't all over.
Yeah, a bit more margin for whatever area you wanted.
So that 2007 was actually pretty good. But I think if you go back now and watch the final, because there weren't as many camera angles, and obviously the ref, the TMO and all that, there were so many things happening in that game. Like I said, they had a star-studded team. They were doing well. They were also doing great at that stage. And I still remember when Albert van der Berg, he picked up the ball and he scored the try. And it was literally like 3 or 4 or 5 minutes left.
Well, they went to 19-13 on the back of that.
Yeah.
So a six-point buffer, solid.
That's it. And then we were standing behind the post, and Morne Steyn was standing. He said to me, listen, don't worry, we're going to win this game. It's happening. And obviously kicked off, a few things happened, and Francie didn't kick the ball out. And if you look at those, especially in that phase of play, there were so many things. Derek Keane was lying on his stomach, pulling the ball back like that. There were knocks in there. But it was a long passage of play. And you could see the boys, even if when just before Brian scored the try, as the ball went out, you could see the Sharks guy, they were out on the legs. Everyone was done. And if you ask Brian, but suddenly this hole just opened. I was standing on the other side of the pitch, and I could see that hole opening. And obviously Brian scored. And Derek, as he did, he took his time a little bit and had that little step. And that was probably the only option they had of for us not to win the game. And then, Derek nailed it. And it was a great experience. And obviously on the back of that, we just won the Super Rugby on the Saturday. So we all got a message from Jake saying, listen, everyone tomorrow, Bloemfontein, Springbok camp. And like, but we just won the Super Rugby. Yes, can we at least just celebrate for a day or whatever it might be? We're not even back in Pretoria yet. And I still remember at that stage, John Smitty and Victor had a chat, and Smitty said to us, "Listen, boys, you can only come on Monday. Have a lekker Sunday. Go celebrate.
Nice.
Drink. Do whatever you do, but go and enjoy it." And all the other guys, they arrived on the Sunday. We arrived on the Monday, and I think that's also again where that all come. It's where the camaraderie starts to build. Although everyone, we've got the Sharks and Stormers all in the Springbok camp. But for Smitty to say something like that to us, "Listen, guys, go and enjoy and go against Jake's wishes at that stage," it was a massive thing for us to say, "Okay, listen, but our captain's got our back." And now we're starting to build something quite nice at that stage.
But it was such a huge moment for SA Rugby. Two SA teams in the final, finally got a Super Rugby champion team.
On South African soil.
Exactly. It's I guess that's a funny thing. I'll bring up with John when we chat to him. But the World Cup squad, okay, so 2007. So just to underline the dominance of the two teams, 30-man squad, 22 came from the Sharks and the Bulls, 11-11. It would have been more, but Pierre unfortunately had to pull out.
Yeah.
So 22 out of the 30 came from those two teams. Again, this was just the golden thing that started it. And I mean, it'd be fair to say that there's no better way to go into World Cup preparation than to be in Super Rugby champions. Like, you guys must have been running so high from that.
Well, definitely. Obviously, you got two South African sides playing in a final, so you start to understand the pressure that comes with a final. Obviously, one side won and one lost, so you know how both feels. So obviously, we spoke to the Sharks and how it feels and everything. So even before we went into the World Cup, you don't want to feel like it. And there were so many stars in that 2007 World Cup squad. And it was quite difficult. If you think Jean got injured, actually, just before we left for France, I pulled my hamstring against Namibia in Cape Town. And obviously, Jake could have said to me, "Listen, you stay at home." But he said to me, "No, he's sticking with me. I can go with." Obviously, won't be on the bench or play the first game. And then John de Villiers got injured. He tore his bicep. And then for someone like Francie to step up from fullback fly-off to go into the centre, and everyone just backed him. He's a youngster. I was 22 at that stage. I turned 22 in June. And Francie was still 18, 19 years old. And for someone to step up like that and the boys just to back him was unbelievable to see. And already in that sense, you could feel the vibe within the team. And at that stage, obviously, we had a drinking culture, but well, not in the Springboks, but everyone knew when we work, and it is after we beat England 36-0 in the first game, we went out to the Champs-Élysées on the day afterwards and had a lekker few beers and everything. But everyone knew what was happening, and that was quite a special side. If you think about it, then France had a blind of a tournament, to be honest.
Yeah,
I think he's a special talent in every which way. If you think how he moves that body around, he's a massive bloke.
Even back then, he was still a unit.
Yeah, he's the size of a forward, but he moves like a back. And for 18 years up to step up like it was just unbelievable. And like I said, the boys backed him. And I think that whole thing started to build with obviously both sides being in the Super Rugby final, getting to experience finals. And obviously now Super Rugby is big, but now you're on the big stage. Now the whole world's looking. And obviously instilling that belief and the fact that you don't want to lose the final. I don't think we ever had a doubt that we can do it.
Well, it stemmed from the Super Rugby. So to take us forward a little bit here, life couldn't have been better. 2007, 2008 Super Rugby campaign. You guys, as defending champions, lose 7 of your 13 matches. You finish 8th. Now, there's a lot of factors going on here, right? There must have been a hangover from the World Cup. There must have been a hangover from the fact that you guys hit so high, but then obviously the big coaching dynamic. So there was a change there.
Yeah, Anneke stepped out and Frans Lineker joined us from the Lions. So, and I think Victor, for he was captain that year. I think Victor went on a stint overseas or something, if I can remember correctly. So there was a lot of changes, although the whole team was actually the same from 2007. It was just one or two things that might have lacked. In all honesty, I actually can't put my finger on it, what it was, because like I said, except for Heineken, there we played the same game plan, everything stayed the same.
So would you have felt that Frans Lineker would have had some sort of connection with Heineken Meyer prior to that to say, "Look, I'm stepping down, you're going to come in here, was there sort of like a handover? I mean, does that kind of happen in rugby coaching circles, do you feel?
I think it might have happened that way because I know Frans and Anneke knew each other quite well from previous years. And I think in 2008, I think Derek also, wasn't that the time he went to Leicester? He and Donny Rousseau joined eventually and John McFarland, our defensive coach.
Nice.
They all went for a stint, I think it was 2008, if I can remember correctly. So when Frans came into the setup, like I said, he didn't change anything. We stuck to the same game plan. Everything stayed the same personnel. Everything stayed the same. I think it was just we were probably a little bit immature in how to handle this whole change. And I think Frieder Pierre was captain most of those games. So the senior side, and it was a lot of Springboks in the side, and a lot of World Cup winners. To be honest, I think it might have been that we might have been a little bit, our heads were a little bit too big in believing that we can do this again. But that was a little bit of I think I got dropped out of Springbok squad in 2008 as well, when Peter de Villiers started taking
rise. Yeah, again, it's just a weird thing to try to comprehend now in that you look how great 2007 was, but that's the fine margins of top-level sport, though. A couple of things changed, not a huge amount, but it can be a big difference between winning and finishing eighth. So then 2009 comes round, and you guys come back, and you end up finishing top of the log here. You had a tough finish, but you managed to pull it all through. And in the last match, to finish top of the log, you gave the Sharks the treatment again in Durban. You beat them by 1 point to finish top of the log. But what did you feel that was kind of different? Did things just get back to normal? Did you just feel like this team clicked a little bit more that year? Like, what was the catalyst that got you guys back on track?
I think the one thing we did a little bit different, I think our preseason in 2009 was a lot harder and tougher because we always had a thing. We put there's a pill in Ibiza. So we had a massive, massive preseason before 2009 season. But also, I think as players and human beings, we matured a lot, having experienced phenomenal year in 2007, massive knockdown in 2008 from where we were in 2007. And again, we just said, listen, we don't want to feel like that anymore. It's not who we are. It's not on our DNA to lose. And again, everyone worked. I think it was the hardest preseason we ever had. And I think that also pulled us through because the thing is, as soon as you get tired, your mind starts to go.
Yeah, you lose that sharpness.
You lose the sharpness. And I think that was also the difference in 2008 because of the insecurities and whatever happens in 2008 when Anneke left and Frans stepped in. It wasn't a bad preseason, but it wasn't as hard or as tough because basically what they did in preseason, they basically broke us down physically and mentally as much as you can. Where some of the players started swearing at the coaches and they were just laughing. Guys were puking, they were laughing. So listen.
When you say preseason, would you guys go away for something like this, or was it?
We usually went down to George for the last 2 weeks of the preseason. Normally in December holidays, just before December holidays, and then you get back. Then you basically have a week or two holiday, and then January you start back up. But the thing was, when you got back from December holidays, you couldn't go drinking or get a pussy. You need to still keep on training. You're on holiday, but because when you get back in January, preseason continues and it's harder than it was in December. So, and also I think the boys actually, they bought into that and saying, listen, okay, we're going to have it till December. I remember, I don't think even I was drinking beer or anything at that stage in December holiday. I was sitting on a stoop there in Harold's Bay, just admiring the view and not doing much. I spoke to a lot of people at that stage, just focusing on training, running out there, the hills in Harold's Bay. So then got back January, and I think the buy in 2009 was just a whole separate thing. Everyone's, we had experience, we had World Cup winners, we had Super Rugby winners. So we just said, listen, it's possible. So let's be the first team to do it twice. And I think 2009 was a phenomenal year. Like I said, we managed to pull it through the last game. I actually got injured in the last game against the Sharks. And I think we played the semi-final, we played against the Crusaders again.
It was against the Crusaders again, yeah. So you got the chance to prove
it. I got injured that the last game of the season before the semi-final. And I remember I went to the doctor on the Sunday and he said to me, listen, you got bad news. he thinks it's going to be 6 weeks. And I'm like, yes, I started to cry. I jumped in my car, sat there, I cried. I phoned my mom and my dad. I said, listen, it was the worst experience of my life. You work so hard to get to this point. And it's all about finals, semifinals and finals. That's what it's about. That's what you work towards. And now they tell me I can't play. So I ended up not playing at the semifinal. I went to hyperbaric chambers and did everything I could to be back on the Saturday. And then it was like basically a miracle happened. Got there on Monday. France said to me, oh, Dave.
So Monday of the final.
Monday of the final.
So it's kind of like the box. If you don't train Monday, you don't play.
You don't play, yeah. Okay. So he said to me, don't train on Monday. And I like, listen, no, but I'm playing this weekend. He said, no, but run with the physios, run with the docs. And I literally strapped up. I got a hip flexor. That was quite a bad one. I was bruised like this. Got there on the Monday, ran with the doc, and it was literally like a miracle. There was nothing. Wow. I had no pain. I had nothing for some reason. And then on the Saturday before the game, they said to me, come, let's strap it up. But I was like, listen, I'm 100%. Don't need injections. Don't need anything. Because at that stage, we were loving injections as well. Went out and probably had the best final ever.
That's incredible. Sorry, Flex, can we get the final team up there again? Because it's worth noting the sort of continuity here. I mean, it's hard to maintain anything once you're at the top there. Next one. So that time round, the Chiefs made it through to the final, and you guys had a home final because of all the hard work you did all year. So very similar team. I mean, Dion Steckman comes in there, as does Divock Potkito on the loose trio. And then backline, Jakub Pretorius is now in the centers with you. JP Nel no longer there.
He actually got Derek Keane on hooker, who moved from – he was a flanker.
Yeah.
Who moved to hooker.
He was the retreaded flanker. And then Zane Kirshner comes in instead of Johan Ritz and 15. But otherwise, kind of similar basis of that team. I mean, you've got Donny Rousseau and Pedri Vandenberg on the bench there. Big, big power there. So, again, solid team, solid core, proven winners, bunch of box in here. You guys then went on to beat the Chiefs in this match, 61-17. I remember Mills Mulyaina after the game. He just said nothing but praise. It's like, this is incredible. For a team to be this good, so dominant, we know what's happening, but we don't know how to play against it. Like, that must have been a really great feeling to 61 in the final.
Yeah, this is actually one of the games I referred to earlier. I think they scored the first try under the post.
That's not a win.
We're behind 7-0.
Yeah.
And we didn't even spoke about it behind the post. We just went out and started playing the game. And it literally within 10 minutes, I think we were at like 21-7 or something like that. And things just worked in a whole different level.
That's right. I always had that feeling with the Bulls team back then. It's like, if it clicks, there's not a team in the world that will come close. And the Crusaders came and went. They tried their luck at the two semifinals prior to winning. There was just something so beautiful about watching this in full chant. And all the sort of naysayers, I know this because I'm a Stormwind supporter, so my surroundings were like, yeah, but it's boring and they only do one kind of thing. It's like, okay, but what do you do against it?
I think it's quite difficult because we started to develop a lot more than the stereotypical rugby where we play, like I said earlier, crash ball rugby or the kicking style. Although at that stage, we had phenomenal within Brian, Akona and Zane. If he puts the ball up, you tell Free, listen, 5 meters here, 3 meters there, and he puts it exactly on the coin there. And then you've got Brian, Akona, and Zane, who can rip anything out the air.
Yeah.
So and if you think about it, it's a lot similar to what the box are playing now.
Exactly.
You got wingers that can get the ball back, and that was part of the game plan. So the quality.
Which is interesting, actually. Sorry to cut you off there, because at the time, I think New Zealand were very pro having really huge wingers because it was a follow on from the Lomu era because they could run over guys. But then through smart kicking, we'd turn those oaks, and they couldn't turn.
That was part of the game plan.
Yeah.
Because as seen, we always said once you have to turn, you got your back against the ball, you're not as quick. And with the speed of Brian Akona and Zane at that stage, it's phenomenal. And even if you look at the box wingers currently, it's insane. So the game plan just worked for us. And then as soon as we get the ball back, you hit them with the big forwards. I don't think it's nice if you got Bakis and Victor now, and then next minute Donny Rousseau comes on, and then Pierre Vandenberg's there. There's so many big boys. We always said everyone's got a plan until you get hit.
Yeah.
And once you get hit once, twice, or the third time is not as much fun. And everyone had something different. And then obviously we had a back line. I think at once they always had it. I always tell the joke. So everyone was a Springbok in the back line except of 13 because I never passed the ball to him. But yeah, and again, everyone's always said, "Oh, scratch by rugby." But if you think about it, Brian O'Banner scored how many tries? O'Connor scored how many tries? Zane Kerr scored how many tries? And I think you hit them with the forwards, and then we got the speed and the pace at the back, and that actually worked out well for us. Started to be moving the contact point, and we were so fit at that stage. We just kept on going. It's like two sets of lungs. You never got tired. Even in the final 2009, I don't remember getting tired. You just kept on going and going, and obviously feeding off the Loftus energy. It's, and a lot of people ask, do you hear the crowd? Do you hear the roar once you stand still? But when you're in it, and I think that Victor also scored the try, and they start playing captain, and you feed off that, and again you feel invincible. I think that's the exact game where I was named Sweepslag, the hooker. He went off and Free went on to score the try. So we didn't care. Big boys can come running. We just hit everyone. Everyone just comes out. We started hitting everyone. And again, the belief was just there. And I think Pierre also, just you got the pace of Pierre Spies. He was unbelievable that final.
I almost thought like Pierre Spies on the high felt during Super Rugby was unfair. It was actually unfair having, because all that guy could do. The thing is,
playing on the high field, we played the Highlanders a few years prior to that. We played the Highlanders 3 o'clock in the afternoon in the summer, and the guys just said it's terrible. It feels like they're standing on your lungs. You can't breathe after 50 minutes.
Yeah.
Obviously, playing in the evening, it's a little bit better. I think that was probably out of all the finals we played, that was a special one. But everyone is different because of different circumstances.
Well, absolutely. But the more you talk, again, this is why I think it's so great to actually highlight this as an incredible era of SA rugby. It's like this is the precursor to why the box is so good now in 2025, because you can do so much physicality with the forwards to soften things up and create space with exciting fast backs to do the rest. And that was always an element. It's like you had box teams that were quite blunt, determined, and they could do a few things here and there. But this is why I think we're so good right now. And it was purely on the back of this. Which then takes us to 2010, right? No team has won Super Rugby in SA twice. No team's ever won it back-to-back. So the hardest thing in sport, as people say, the whole cliche goes, it's not about getting to the top, it's staying at the top. You spoke about 2009 being an incredibly tough preseason after a terrible 2008. What was the vibe at the start of the 2010 season, knowing that you guys are more than the target right now? Everybody wants to have a go at you. Everyone feels that they know what you're going to do. So what did it feel like going into that season?
2010 was actually, I think we were a little bit more level-headed than we were from 2007 to 2008. Also, we had a few players in the team, with the likes of Derek Keane, moved from flank to hooker. I think you didn't get, they never got the credit that was due to them. And I think having those guys, some of those guys in the team, they pushed us a lot harder. And it's not like if you're a bok, listen, you sit out, you jump in, and you're supposed to pull the guys and push them. And I think it's just the balance we had on the side, and the respect we had for one another, and saying, listen, boys, it's not about me, it's not about you, it's about us. Because remember, long after we finish, Bulls are still going to be there. So let's live in the moment and do what we can, and Mvaini always said, firma goat for the oudag. Once you sit in 10, 15, 20 years' time, you sit around a fireplace and you start telling stories. So, and we thought about it. It's like, yeah, that's a great analogy of how to put it. So, almost, let's get firma goat for the oudag. And we just wanted to build more and more and more on what we've done up to this point. And again, then you had to carry it in front of your nose and saying, listen, no side's ever done it twice in a row. So let's be that side. And obviously 2010 was also the Soccer World Cup.
Well, this is what makes this, it's actually so great that we can finish on this year, because so much was going on here. And we'll get to the finals in a sec, obviously with a different stadium, because now you were doing it away from Loftus. But to start off, so 2010, you guys started off so well. You're averaging 50 points a game for your first four matches. You're beating decent teams, but clapping them now. Tour was quite difficult, lost to the Blues and the Reds on tour. Came back, though, beat the Crusaders at home again. So now you've got a streak against these guys. And then in your final match against the Stormers, you were, I guess, guaranteed top of the log. Did you guys have a full-strength team that time?
No. At that stage, most of the first team didn't start that game. There were a couple of youngsters like Gerrit-Jan van Velzen, I remember, he played. They ended up losing, but I think it was a great experience for the guys, for the younger boys to go out and play that. We actually in the beginning of the season, when we saw the fixtures come out, we were sitting in Hatfield, or was it Hatfield or something, Trademarks at that stage, sitting and we looked at the fixtures and we said, how funny will it be if we end up top of the log and we send a different side to go play the Stormers because we're already in the final or the semis. And that actually ended up happening. And everyone's like, yes, that'd be pretty cool. We've never done that. So let's give it a go. And yeah, it ended up exactly as we planned.
So cool. So inevitably, top of the log. So what was the vibe around, okay, guys, you don't actually have Loftus anymore because it was a World Cup, FIFA World Cup stadium. You guys can't be scrumming and doing what you do on a field that's now meant to be perfect for the football. Was it always going to be Orlando Stadium? Was that always, like, how into the season did that become confirmed?
I think it was almost just after midway through the season. They told us, listen, in the next few weeks, you're going to have to move away from Loftus and start training at. We didn't even get the proper Tikkies ground. We had to go to the Groenteloof campus.
All right.
Where we trained. There was a gym there, obviously not the same as Loftus, but
even use the gym facilities at Loftus.
Nothing. We weren't even allowed in the stadium almost.
Wow.
So we had to move everything. So we moved to the Tikkies Groenteloof campus. Obviously, we had like Basil Karzis, who was a trainer at that stage. He just said to us, listen, boys, don't worry. It's going to differ, but everything you do, everything you need is going to be there. And it was exactly that. Obviously, that you get used to your route every day, which you drive to. I was always in a routine. It's a different song, pump the music. I had a black X6 at that stage, pumping the music, psyching myself up for this training. Now, instead of 5 to 7 minutes, now it's taking me 20 minutes. So now I had to incorporate something completely different.
You had to get a lot more depth in your playlist.
Yeah. So everything changed. But as soon as we got there, everyone just said, listen, well, you know, it's just a training fire. It's not the pitch. And I don't think the stadium for the final, the semifinal final was set at that stage. They were talking about Orlando and the big soccer city.
Okay.
Was the other one for the finals, depending again where it's happening. But so there was a lot of changes. But I think at that stage, we didn't actually care much about what's happening. We got a job to do. You go there, do your job, and forget about the sideshows of the World Cup and the way you're training and all those types of things.
But it really was. I mean, I guess sideshows is right. I went with some mates to Orlando to watch that semi-final. I've actually got a picture. I must try to dig it up. I'm actually wearing, James, you'd love this. I'm wearing a hat with actual born bull's horns in it. My dad was even here for that game. It was quite something. But it was a really cool fan moment because here you've got the Bulls at the absolute peak going and playing a game in Soweto, which in itself had huge ramifications as to how we see rugby. And people were now making this, like, Loftus was a fortress. It was a place of rugby. It's almost like a pilgrimage site at that time. And now it's going to Soweto. In its own right, you guys had no idea at the time, but you were actually getting 2010 FIFA World Cup kicked off by doing that. Because suddenly everyone was so obsessed with sport and getting behind a winning team. So you beat the Crusaders there. And again, like, you guys must have just felt so good you can beat them anywhere. And this just maybe gave you even more belief going into the final.
I must say, just before the semi-final, we went for the captain's run at the stadium the first time. We actually went to go and we might have trained once or twice, but the first time we went to the stadium, remember that, you're driving there past all the Shabins and everything. And you literally could start feeling the vibe. The Shabins, everyone had flags, blue ball flags. You stop at a gas filling station, and like everyone's just like, and the guys actually putting the fuel in the cars and whatever, they actually knew your name. So it's quite funny. It's not even Pretoria. You're way out of Pretoria, and yeah, everyone knew your name, and they're like, everyone's so excited. So. Because obviously, in the first time we went out, you're quite squeaky, quite scared. You had no idea where you're going, what are you diving into. So then we actually thought, listen, this is actually pretty cool. Because all the way from Pretoria to Joburg, it's just blue flags everywhere. So that was quite special. And once we went into the stadium, you could actually feel the sound staying within the stadium. So it's not as big as Loftus, but the noise was much more.
It's more enclosed. So yeah, it
was on the stadium. But just to go back a few, so I actually met my wife in March 2010, which I'm married to now. My first date, our first date, was the semi-final.
All right.
Yeah, so it was quite a obviously, I had this girl in the stand, so I wanted to perform, not just for...
How did you work that out, though? Because it's quite a big moment for you to play a semi-final, and you thought this would be a good first date. I mean,
it's quite fun.
Like, feel like you had to over-impress her. I mean, you're ready.
I actually met her in March at JP Nell's wedding.
Okay.
In 2010. And then I didn't speak to her for like 3 months, whatever. And then I phoned her and I said, let's go for coffee. And I wasn't... my whole game plan towards her also changed. So I thought, listen... pull out all the stops. I like this girl. Might even want to marry her. And I left the first date, left, and I phoned her. I said, listen, I got a bit of a thing on the weekend. Do you want to come? You want to join? I said, but I'm not going to drive there with you. You're going to sit on a bus. And she's like, okay, it sounds pretty cool. What is the thing? I said, no, it's a Super Rugby semi-final. She's like, but who am I going to sit with? And I said, no, with other girls, but I'll see you afterwards. It was actually a pretty cool time at that stage.
So cool. Extra pressure, though. Got to play well for that one.
Listen, it was all about the fans in the stadium, but they had one girl in the stadium I wanted to impress. So
that's smart, though. Actually, give yourself more motivation.
okay
so then it. And then a week later, second date at the final, or did you
second
see-
date final. Final, obviously special. Again, two South African sides playing the Stormers. Stormers, Brian O'Banner left. He went to Stormers playing for the Stormers.
So hang on a second, actually. Flex, can you bring up these teams here? Because again, I love looking back at old teams. So Bulls team, again, it's very, very similar in 2010. Francois Hocart's number 11 because BH has now gone down to the Cape. Gerard van der Heever is the other wing. Otherwise, there's a couple of... I mean, Flip van der Merwe comes in on the bench here for you guys there. Otherwise, it's a very similar team. It's very... like that forward pack is... exact same forward pack.
Okay. Yeah, that didn't change much.
And then a couple of changes in the backs. Okay, did you have a quick look at the Stormers there? So in 2010, the Stormers, there's BH, little turncoat down to the Stormers. Although, I mean, that was a great moment for in the Cape to have the Bulls player to come down. So he was 11. Skalkberger, Francois Lowe, Dwayne Vermeulen. Amazing loose trio for the Stormers there. Andries Becker, he was like the Archaeus Snowman of the day. Brock Harris was playing there. I think he was already like 30 years old. And then their backline was actually pretty good. Devil Duvenacher and Peter Grant. And Peter Grant was one of those guys that he was like an okay Bok kind of player, but I feel like this season he really kicked on because he was kicking as well. Yeah, Jean de Jong, your opposite number on that day with Jacques Ferry. So good centre pairing. BH Nkeo Aplon as the wings and Joe Peterson. Yeah, it was a good Stormers team. It really was.
But lots of Boks in there as well.
But UOGs, you started well and they just couldn't come back. But I guess that's what you guys did.
Yeah, listen, so in 2007, there was a youngster who joined us named Francois Hocart. So he became like my little brother. So obviously at that stage, now he's on the winger, 11, same as Brian at that stage. And
he was originally brought in as a scrum off, right?
He was originally a scrum off. Yeah. Now he's playing on the wing. And obviously, but Hoche had this silent confidence. It doesn't matter what he's doing. I don't know if he knows what's going on or whatever, but he never doubted himself or anyone else. He's just like, we walked into the same. He said, yes, I said to me, why not? Yes, it's going to be a lucky day. We're going to club these hacks. And obviously, when he broke through the first time, he had the wing at the back flapping.
Yeah, that little neck curtain that he had was very impressive.
So, and he had he had a still confidence, which it's almost arrogance, but not just arrogance. And to have someone like that in your side, obviously playing. Brian's now playing for the Stormers, and he's just says, "Yeah, we're gonna club them today. It's gonna be lacquer." And I think everyone just started feeding off that as well. That game actually went quite well, quite fast. There's not a lot of memories I've got within the game itself, except for Ochi's try and maybe one or two other things. But that was a completely different atmosphere and win that we did the previous year. I think the fact playing in Orlando. You're not the home stadium, and again, you've got the whole South Africa there. Everything goes because it's a historical moment. And it's never been done before, and now we're playing the Super Rugby final at Orlando. Loads of people flocking there, people singing at your beans and drinking. It was a really special moment at that stage to do something like that, and obviously hosting the Soccer World Cup on the same year.
Yeah, it really, really was. I mean, we've all been through certain like fan times where we can remember. For me, though, this is still the biggest. And then getting into the FIFA World Cup from there, whether you liked football or not, it was like such an extension on that. But again, amazing time. 2007 Rugby World Cup, guys won that. You guys won Super Rugby. 2009, beating the British and Irish Lions at home. There was the winning of the Tri Nations, beating New Zealand away from home. This period now, which we just covered in the space of, what is it, the 4-year period, I think it will forever be hard to beat, because it's great the fact that the Box won the Rugby World Cup 2019, 2023, aiming for 2027. But these are almost blips in a greater time where rugby felt so different here. Again, like Loftus being so packed all the time. Getting into those game days, I mean, looking back at it now, like what would an average game day kind of be like? So you would wake up relatively late, or what was the average day?
I never sleep late. Like now I wake up at 20 past four in the mornings. I used to wake up like maybe 6:45. I lived alone at that stage. First thing, start pumping the music as hard as I can, because music just, I get my whole personality changes because of music. So it starts to psych me up. And at that stage, I had certain songs, which just play that for me and I'll run through a wall. I don't care. I do that, start making breakfast. Well, myself and Dewald Potgieter always went for breakfast. There's a little place in just off Linwood in Pretoria called Lamanaku. And Dewald lived on that side of Linwood. I lived on this side. So we always, and Brian also lived there for a little bit. So we always went there on a before captains on a Friday, Saturday, we always went there for breakfast. So I get up, go for breakfast, get back home, again, pump the music, maybe relax a little bit, start packing my bag. And then once I jump on my Black X6, again, music starts to pump. But as a very chilled, I must say, when I had the opportunity, I'd go for, and depending on what time the game is, as it was a late game, then I'd see my parents beforehand. Otherwise, just stay around the house, take it as easy as possible. And then 4 hours before the game, 4.5 hours, we usually get to the stadium. So you can see we had like beds there and all those types of things. So boys can just start focusing. We had a walkthrough and then like a lunch. Then you could go sleep or do whatever you want. Just take it easy. So you get your mind off things that are happening outside or at home. And then slowly, once Heineken says, okay, it's team meeting time, then you start to get into things and start to focus. I must say, I actually loved game times. It was a balance between nerves and like being confident in what's going to happen. I usually start playing.
It never got older for you, had like the nerves and that stuff.
No, I think one of the things I miss probably the most is that feeling, game day feeling. Obviously, you miss the players and the boys around you and all that, and especially game days, running out in front of a full stadium, 50,000 people. That is special.
You can't get that anywhere else.
No, you like, can't replicate. No, I've done Ironmans and a few different things. It's not the same. It's just that thing. You get to Loftus, it's empty, or the stadium, and slowly you start to see it building up, until 50,000 people, and then it's proper. Then
a Loftus 50 compared to any other 50 around the world is also a special thing.
No, Loftus obviously, yes, it's a whole different crowd in Pretoria than you get at, let's say, Ellis Park or Cape Town. I must say, Cape Town is also special. When we're still at Newlands, Newlands was a special stadium.
Yeah.
I've actually never been to the new stadium, to be honest.
All right.
At that stage, it just, as you see it building up and people flocking into the stadium, you can actually, when you're in the change, you can start feeling the vibe. When you run out to start to warm up, yes, then it starts to get like like I said earlier, it's like you can basically do anything that's possible at that stage. And I think that's the one thing that Loftus gave me. You feed off the energy that other stadiums are the same, but not as much. Obviously, I was a Bull for 10 odd years. So that was probably one of my favorite things. And that's probably one of the things I miss.
I can imagine, like, that doesn't gear you up for normal life, because you're only going to step down after that in more ways than one. But it's like, what excites you? So, like, nothing can do that again.
I must say, like, 4 years before I retired, I started planning for life after rugby. And yeah, it's there's nothing that can prepare you for that. It's better, not after you've experienced what I've experienced at Loftus and at other stadiums. It's just different. And I took my son, he's 4 years old. I took him to the game the other day, a few months back. And he said to me, "Papa, I have a little bit of a scene." I said, "Okay." So I phoned Edgar. I said, "Listen, is it possible for us to get or stand on the pitch while the guys are on out?" He said, "Yeah, sure." So I took him there. And now you've got 30,000 people there. And my son said to me, "Was it like this when you played?" I said, "No, it wasn't like this. It was fuller. There was more people."
Because it's going to be so cool. He's old enough to appreciate this, watching videos.
Yeah, my wife actually said to me a few weeks ago, "You must actually start." My daughter's 7 now. You must actually start telling them what happened and what you guys did and all that. Because we watched the rugby on Saturday. Was it not Saturday? The weekend before. And my son's obviously seen photos of me with a long blonde hair. So, and Faf goes onto the pitch and he says to me, "Papa, is that day?" So slightly they're starting to get into it, which is quite nice. Because obviously I got loads of jerseys and still at home. So they sit there, they tell me, so what is this? What is the spring? What is this jersey, the green spring? I said, "No, that's the World Cup final jersey and that's a Super Rugby jersey." And then tell us stories. Where have you been and what you've done? And it's actually then when you start to realize what has happened for the 17 odd years we play rugby and how many times we've traveled and what we've done and the places we've seen and the people we've met and the experiences we've had in terms of 90 odd thousand people at a World Cup final, which is on the world stage, where it's not Loftus, we're just local, it's all over. And then you start to like reminisce in the past, which is actually, now it's nice. And even talking about it to you today, there's so many flashbacks that comes back. In 2006, for instance, we had a game. We played on Saturday. I think we lost. And we went through the whole week. And Heineke on the Friday before the game, I can't remember before what game it was, Heineke said to us, "Okay, come. We're not going into the auditorium today for the pre-match talk. We're going to sit here." It was on the Friday before the captains. And there was a few cooler bags in the change room. And everyone's like, "What's happening?" And Heineke said, "Well, open that." We opened the cooler boxes, full of beers. It's a Friday, we're playing on Saturday. He said, "Well, grab one each." So we grab the beers and we think, "Okay, what are we going to do with this?" And he said, "Open it." Everyone's looking at one another and he went, everyone opens. He said, "Well, I'll down it." And he's like, "Coach, but we're playing tomorrow." He said, "Down it. Because the only time you guys talk is when you drink." So we down a beer, went out for a captain's run. I think we gave the team quite a bit of a hiding. So there's lots of stories like that that's coming to mind. Once you start dissecting and going through the different years and the different eras, which is actually quite nice, because I don't think we talk about it that much.
This is the thing. Like, this is what I've always wanted out of a podcast and a show, is to actually really honor good moments, because there's always the next team, there's always the next player, there's always the next tournament. And even as fans, we get so caught up because there's far too much sport out there. And I think careers need to be looked at and actually really appreciated, because just doing basic research for the show, I forgot how much I love Super Rugby. And as a fan, I mean, you got the best memories, but as a fan, I remember times of going to Loftus during this time as well. I remember who I was with. I remember the things where I was at in my life. And it just brings me back so much joy. And that's what sport really is. It's joy on so many different levels.
Yeah, well, I think we've said it so many, every time we win a World Cup, it brings people together. And even you making a mistake like supporting the Stormers, which I forgive you
birth.
For.
That was birth. I grew up there, went to school.
I was born in the Free State in Welkom, but I'm not a Free State supporter.
Yeah, but I mean, the Bulls gave you so much.
No, true. But you got me off my story now. Yeah. So I think it's sport brings so many people together. And I've listened to previous podcasts where it's supposed to be, you speak about golf and the football. I'm not a massive soccer fan at all. I do love golf and I watch the Masters and all that. And it's nice to see now that I'm finished with rugby, where you missed all those types of things. Now we get together, we watch a game at someone's house. We have a bribe beforehand. We go to Loftus. We go to Ellis Park, where it might be. And it's nice to see how people actually put the effort in and make time to do things like that, because we never experienced it like that. So now it's pretty cool. And being able to take my family and my son and my daughter to as well, it's actually quite nice, I must say. And if it's Masters, if it doesn't matter, if it's a big game, we're there. We watch it. And that's quite a nice thing what that sport does, which I don't think a lot of other things gives you that ability to bring. I've made so many friends, random friends at random places, just because of sport.
Exactly. Does your wife still like going to games?
I don't think my wife has actually ever watched a game, to be honest. She's always there, but it's for the wine and the. But I don't think she's actually ever watched games.
She definitely watched the first two games, for sure.
That I think she watched. Well, I'm also not so sure, to be honest. I think she likes the fact that it was a Orlando Stadium and the experience was pretty good. But I think she actually both times took a friend with. So I don't actually know if they watched the games. Because I remember when I played abroad in England, she'd always ask people, I was like, what happened now? I said, no, Wijnand scored a try. I was like, okay, yes, sir. Thanks for telling me. I'll tell him afterwards. Mooi drie.
So, look, there's so many other things I'd love to ask you, but, I mean, we can't be here all day. I do have to ask you, and we'll finish on a lighter note after this, but Super Rugby ultimately, it died in my point. I know it still exists, Super Rugby, Pacifica, whatever. They say teams aren't there. After this incredible era that we spoke about today, it went to Super 15, and then it felt like it went to Super Rugby Infinity. No one understood the concept. There was playing away, there was the regionals, and it became a mess. Did you feel like it was always going to kind of get there? They were going to try expand it for money purposes? Or, I mean, does that make you feel at all sad that Super Rugby isn't what it was?
Most definitely. Obviously, if you look at I don't even watch the Super Rugby now. I must say, it's not, the best competition to watch. I actually enjoy the URC. But I think some of the reason, obviously, there's always money that you look at. But also developing players. And if you look at the New Zealand side, since South Africa stepped out, obviously Australia and New Zealand, in my opinion, has taken a back step in terms of world rugby. And if you take with the URC, the sides up north has obviously stepped up quite a bit. But also what I think the URC did is it gave a lot of players that played in the European League a better chance to eventually play for the Springboks. I liked Super Rugby. I must say, like I said earlier, Super 14 was probably the best competition where you had best of both. You had a home and away. When they started changing it into pools and you only play certain sides, so then it started like watching down a little bit in terms of you get a side that's not going to play the Crusaders or it's not going to play the Chiefs or whatever. I think then even with the Super 15, it started to be not as great as Super 14. Because I think it's easy to win when you play at home, but when you play away, it's a completely different ballgame, especially traveling to New Zealand, which is 11 hours of the turnaround time. You travel for 14, 15, 18 hours.
The weather's cuck in the stadium.
Weather's terrible. I've been to New Zealand quite a number of times, and I actually said to my wife, if I never go there again, it'd be too soon. I actually hate that place. I think it's sort of watering you down. It's when you become money hungry, and that's exactly what it is. And I think New Zealanders and Australians never gave South Africans credit in terms of what actually they brought to the whole Super Rugby thing.
Oh yeah,
in developing players, the actual value of the competition. And obviously, if you think about it, I think the viewership was 2/3 South African.
Well, we were the business. Like we were the.
Oh, well, we still are.
We're almost like the dad paying for the wedding. It's.
But I must say, moving up north for the URC, a lot of people don't understand the competitions again with the URC and the European Cup and all that, and the Challenge Cup and the Champion Cup. Well, my dad, he watches it every year, and he still doesn't understand what the Challenge Cup and the Championship and all those things in the URC. So then I have to explain it again. But I think it developed our players quite a bit. Obviously, traveling is a lot easier because there's no time difference. And when it's summer here, it's winter there. So now you have to adapt to different weather circumstances. It's cold. It's you go from 30-odd degrees heat here to minus degrees there.
Well, the French guys were crying the most about that this season.
Yeah, and it's I must say it's difficult. I think the one thing, obviously, like I said, jet lag is not a massive thing. And it gave a lot of players opportunity which gave the South African selectors an opportunity to actually look at it. So I think it widened the pool of players that we used to look at.
Absolutely.
Obviously, I think also what they did in terms of you play overseas, you can still play for the box. Where we played in 2010, 11, 12, if you played overseas, you're not allowed to play for the box. So it gave the guys the freedom to actually, you know what, go make some money, but come back and you play for pride when you play for the box, not that they're not making money. But I quite like the URC. I think it's a great competition. I do miss Super Rugby. I think that's probably the best competition they ever were. It's strength against strength.
It really was. And I think, you know, that's why I love bringing up the team sheets just now, is that when the things happened, we knew the opposition almost as well, because that was a really good time. Fewer teams. We saw them internationally. We saw them there. Even when Leinster come out here, or the best of the UFC teams come out here, you can see the crowds aren't there. It's like they're not entirely sure who they're seeing, which is a shame. It really is.
It is. But it's also, like I said, that golden era when we played, you basically knew the Crusaders, the Chiefs. You know the whole side. Where now it's, you come Leinster come, you might know one or two Oaks playing. Other than that, there's a lot of sides playing. I don't think you know anyone in the Welsh sides.
Tough to sell a Zebra game.
Yeah, so you got the Scarlets coming. Okay, but you're watching the Scarlet, but who's in there that, and to be honest, people like, they like Euros. So if they see a Sia Kulisi coming to play or whoever, they go there to watch that player play. And maybe it might be a 1% chance, maybe just get to see that player on the side when he comes out the tunnel.
Yeah.
And that's what people want to see. So and if at that stage when Dan Carter and Richie McCaulker, people flocking, they want to see the All Blacks coming to play.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that's a little bit missing from URC, but still, it's a great competition. It's early days. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take some time. You know, it's the exact same conversation we're having with O'Connor as well, is that once we get to understand the teams, and how good the structure is, and there is actually still a lot of strength versus strength happening. It's just we don't know those guys yet. Because when we go over there, we're playing tough games. It's still going to be a strength versus strength tournament, but we'll get there.
I think we'll get there. And it makes traveling a little bit easier for the boys. For the players. So I quite like the Challenge Cup and the Championship where the French sides get involved and everything, because that brings a whole different dynamic to the game. You can see if the guys go play, if it's winter in UK and they go play in Wales, you can see the game plan changes completely. It's not they're not as expansive as they normally are, as they would be at a Loftus, for instance. And if you take the final this year between Leinster and the Bulls, you can see the boys, like, they're flabbergasted. They don't know if they're coming or going. It's probably one of the worst matches I've ever watched. And I actually, my son and Akar van der Merwe's kids on the same school, so I see him at school quite often. And I saw him on the Monday or the Tuesday. I said, I'm not going to say much. He said, yeah, I know, we were cuck. I said, no, you weren't cuck. You were terrible, beyond that. But I think it's getting there. I must say, for the Bulls, for instance, having played three finals, not pulling it through, it's quite a sad thing to see, because we were actually pretty good in finals
exactly
years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason maybe Jake said, okay, well, you know what, it is what it is. Maybe there needs to come new blood to try and motivate these guys in a whole different sense. And maybe Johan is the guy.
I hope so. I mean, I know I'm a Stormers fan deep down, but I live in Johannesburg. My home stadium always feels like Loftus.
I actually see you at Loftus quite often.
I love it there. I absolutely love it there. Seriously, I'm the biggest Soti you could think of. My parents immigrated from England. I'm very English, but after about two brandies, I identify as Afrikaans. We need to finish on a light kind of note. I've got some quick fire questions to wrap it up. You speak a lot about getting amped up at music before your games, whether it's card, home, into it. Which teammate did you feel was almost strangely calm before a game? Like, too calm?
Kijk, for Rita Priya, it's quite difficult to see emotion there. And before a game, you could see his focus, but his expressions doesn't change. And I think maybe between Rita Priya and Morne Steyn, between those two. And they were obviously the guys who had probably the most pressure.
Kind of reassuring as you're 9 and 10, your game winners.
So you never had an issue with those guys. You just, if you're feeling nervous, just look at one of those two guys and you're like, because you know what, we'll be okay today.
Toughest opponent in Super Rugby. It doesn't necessarily have to be another 12. An Oak that you would be mindful of in the field against.
Super Rugby.
Yeah.
Matt Gitto. I hated playing against. He's small, super strong, fast. I honestly hated playing against him.
Interesting. Best nickname of a fellow rugby player in your whole professional career?
Best nickname? Does it include myself? No, we've had so many. That suits the guy pretty good. I'm probably safe for Morne Steyn. We call him Fully. Because he always said he has got ostrich eggs for Streisayers.
That's fair. Okay, this is probably the toughest question. Maybe I'll leave this to last. Most memorable match. So you spoke about that final where you guys put 61 on. You just come back from Rackers injury.
Listen, I was fortunate to play in a lot of nice games. So most memorable, I think 2009 Super Rugby final, and I'm not talking about playing my first test and everything, but 2009, after getting injured, coming back, playing the final, beating the Chiefs, I ended up being man of the match in that game as well. So that's quite a special one for me.
Okay. The best 13 you've ever played alongside? Whole career.
Alongside?
You run out and go, Mike, today, like, we're a good centre pair.
Myself and JPNL. I love playing with that guy. We played the Sharks one year, and he actually tackled the one guy with his malt burst. So, you know, if JP was on, he was on.
Yeah.
So he never got the credit that he should get, but he was as tough as nails. He's fast, he's a hard worker. Because sometimes I did stupid stuff, and I knew he'd have my back. Not taking away anything from Jacques or Jean or completely different to JP, but I spent so many years playing with JP. I love playing with that rugby.
Most undervalued quality of a rugby player? A good one.
Ooh, most underrated.
Well, so the most undervalued quality, because everyone wants to be big, strong, fast, confident, all these kind of things. What would you say would be the most undervalued quality of a player to be successful?
Undervalued quality. I think your mind, being strong in your mind, is a lot of people put a lot of emphasis on, like you say, being strong, being fast. But your mind brings you the calmness. And listen, you can look at the likes of Cheslin Kobe. So many coaches said you're too small. Listen, he's unbelievable. Kurtley Aronson. There's a small doesn't matter how big. I got a nephew playing at the Cheetahs currently, and he says to me, "Now he's on the bulk up. I said, "Listen, are you 22 years old? He's bigger than me. You fine. Work on mental strength, and the rest will come. Because tough situations, hard to handle that, hard to stay calm, and hard to make plans under pressure. Those types of things build character. So
exactly. I mean, you could be playing against an Oak with both centers are targeting you that day because that's the choice. How do you bounce back from that?
I think when you asked me about the toughest opponent, you probably thought I was going to say Nonu.
Yeah, someone like that.
We played so many times against Nonu. I knew Nonu couldn't pass to the one side. He only could kick with one foot. There's certain things he did. So it was actually easy playing against him. It wasn't difficult. And it's just a mind thing. Remember, bigger is not always better. Like I said, I think your mind is because it built character. Character is a massive characteristic, I think. Probably one of the best characteristics you need. But this is something you can build it over time and experiences.
Okay. Springbok three-peat in Australia, yes, no?
I think at the current situation, we can keep it off, most definitely.
Okay, leave it at that. Favorite Afrikaans musician?
Listen, I must. Okay, Kurt Darren is always. I don't listen to his music much, but he's always catchy. He brought out this whole pop spinnacle thing the other day. Which
I was playing it this last weekend in Spain. It was going well. Yeah,
people go wild about it too.
Okay, final question. This is a tough one. People always look back at the greatest teams, and it's so difficult because there's different iterations of the team we spoke about today. But if you were to look back and say 2007, 2009, 2010, which would you say would be the best team of those three in this era?
Probably 2009.
Yeah. After what you've just said to me for the last 90 minutes, like, it all makes sense, actually.
Yeah, I think 2009, it's just everything about that side. Although we had 2010, our road to the final was a lot easier. I think we lost two games, plus the Storm was three games.
Yeah.
But I think the 2009 team, in terms of mental strength, physicality, it's just a completely different animal to all the other sides.
And coming back after 2008's disappointment.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that play a role to it. But I think the 2009 side is quite a special one for me.
Nice one. Ben, that's Yeah, I mean, I've wanted to have a long chat about your career for quite some time now. And I think this is a beautiful thing to be able to do with some water under the bridge, some time behind us now. You've got incredible memories that you can now enjoy for the rest of your life. And as I said, like when your son gets older, start watching some of these matches, it's going to be so special. You keep taking him to Loftus, you'll keep having that. And it's something that you've absolutely earned. It really is a beautiful thing. And, you know, just as a fan, like, I mean, I'm even older than you, and I'm the biggest sort of fanboy for moments like this. And it's so cool, and it's so great that every generation coming forward now can look back at something like this and say, that was excellence, that was brilliance. We must emulate those guys, and we can do it ourselves one day. So thank you. I mean, thank you for sharing all your memories. This was a lot of fun for me. And, I'm sad Super Rugby died, but it's so cool that we had that era of which you were absolutely integral to.
Most definitely. No, thank you for having me. It's quite nice going down memory lane. I said it brings back a lot of memories and stories, things I haven't thought about for maybe 10, 12 years. So it's actually nice going down that road. And like you said, I think it was quite a special era. And I think that set the tone for a lot was going on now in terms of the guys want to perform. There was a lot of great players that played in that jersey before me, and there's a lot of players that are going to come after you. And I think a lot of players realize that. So that's why they're stepping up and doing probably the utmost best they can do. Because also, back in the day, the competition to play in that jersey, it was difficult, it was tough, but it's not the same as now.
Yeah.
Which I think makes it for the guys a little bit more difficult.
Special. Special shout out to Eric Clavier and Rob the Jew. You guys took me to Loftus back in this era. This is what made me actually like the – I don't believe in second teams. I'm a Stormers fan, but I've always had a really, really great time with the Bulls and this era, and this podcast alone has made me very, very happy. Catch you back next week. Sandile will be back with me. I think he might have been trying to open a sports bar in Ibiza. I don't know how it's gone, but he'll be back here, and it'll be a lot more rugby coming up because this is the season for it. We keep talking about it. This is the time. The Box are going to go to New Zealand. They're going to win those two games over there. We're going to go to France. We're going to win that one, and we're going to beat the Irish later in the year. There's so much rugby to look forward to. Catch you back soon.